This is recorded on the 16th day of June, 1970. It is an interview between John H. Moriarty, Director of Libraries at Purdue University, retired, and Professor Robert B. Eccles. This is recorded for the archives of Purdue University. I'll say this once more, just for the tone level, and that is, this is recorded of an interview. This is a recorded interview between Director of Libraries, Dr. John H. Moriarty, and Professor R.B. Eccles for the Purdue University Archives. Mm-hmm. Dr. Moriarty, let's start out with the obvious questions. Where were you born, and where were you educated, and so on? In other words, let us lead up to your accepting your position as Director of Libraries at Purdue, and when?
I was not a young man when I came to Purdue. I was pretty well formed. I was born on November 9th, 1903, in Waterbury, Connecticut. My father was of Irish descent, which meant something in Waterbury at the time. My mother was Hudson Valley Dutch, which meant something in New York State at the time. This seems a little old-fashioned to me now, but it seemed very important when I was a young person. I went to the public schools of Waterbury. I graduated from high school there in 1922. Before I graduated from high school, a great deal of concern about where I should go to college occurred in our family. My grandmother offered to pay my way to Holy Cross because she was a very devout Catholic. My grandfather was not a devout Catholic, and my father followed him, and so I was fairly free in where I would go, but the question was who would have me. Because colleges at that time, at least to those of us who were 18 years old, seemed to be very selective about who they would take. And so a month before Christmas in 1921, Christmas 21, I made arrangements with Columbia University to go down in January to New York City and to take the entrance tests at Columbia, which were then the very advanced tests of the intelligence test rather than the subject matter tests. My IQ was to be tested. They would assume that the college entrance boards and other things that I had taken equipped me for this. So I went down, and I was so young that my mother felt she had to go with me, which she did. And we had a remarkable experience because I had heard about Eugene O'Neill's Anna Christie being a critical success, and I wanted to go and hear Pauline Lord play that role. My mother went with me, and so did an aunt who was a religious person, wife of a minister in Brooklyn. My mother's side of the family were very Protestant. She, of course, was completely scandalized by Anna Christie. I don't think I understood it, but I knew something very important was happening. The next day, I went and took my tests at Columbia. I found my way by hook and crook across Manhattan Island and got there on time. I did fairly well in the test and was accepted. One of the important reasons for going to Columbia was that I was going to be able to get a job at the Engineering Society's library. All through high school, I had worked in a library at the Bronson Public Library in Waterbury as a page and then as an assistant of sorts as I became a four-year member of the staff. And so I was put on the desk at the Engineering Society's library nights. This was a responsible job because I was the only human being in the place evenings until 10 o'clock. And so 5 nights a week and all day Saturday from 1 until 10, I ate my meal on the job. I was for 2 years at the Engineering Society's library. By that time, I had saved up enough money so that I did not have to do so much work my last 2 years at Columbia. And I was able to go into extracurricular activities, mostly into the play shop there at the time. And I was in 2 or 3 academic plays with considerable pleasure to myself. When I finished with Columbia, I began to look around for a job. My family, of course, had a property back in Waterbury, but my father was determined I shouldn't return. And so I went looking for a job in New York City in 1926. It wasn't too hard. The New York Telephone Company, which was a subsidiary of the AT&T, took me into its training program with very little hunting on my part, and I took a preparatory job and went up to Buffalo, New York. The importance of all this will come out later. For 7 years, I was a junior executive with the New York Telephone Company. By this time, of course, we were in a deep depression. I began to find the telephone company firing people with 1, 2, or 3 year tenure. They never got up as high as my tenure, which was 7 years, but I nevertheless wasn't taking any chances. And so when they made an offer of $100 a week, $100 a year for each year you were on the job and 2 weeks vacation added, I took that offer, collecting over $700, and went back to Columbia to go into library school. I looked back at that time on my library work with pleasure. I looked around for other job opportunities and didn't see anything that I would be able to use, and so I went into the Columbia Library School. I took the bachelor's degree on top of my Columbia BA, and I stayed on a second year, largely because there was no employment, and took the master's degree. At the end of that time, I was hired on a temporary basis at the Queensboro Public Library in the Science and Technology Room. This was due partly to connections that I had made while I was in the Waterbury Public Library, the Bronson Library there, with librarians who were interested in science and technology. I only stayed there about 3 months because the Cooper Union, which is an engineering as well as an art school, had an opening for it, a librarian, the head of the library, and so I went there and applied. The man who was hiring me was much more impressed with my telephone experience than he was with any library background, and after making inquiries at Buffalo, New York about my telephone background and receiving warm assurances as he quoted to me that I was an effective person, he hired me at once as head of his library, although I had nothing but academic and experience, in a way, if you will, professionally, to offer. I stayed at Cooper Union for 3.5 years. I was drafted into teaching as well as to being the librarian there, and on the whole, having my own shop at the very beginning was perhaps the very best way for me to learn library work. At the same time, of course, it kept me in with the science and technology material that I had always been associated with in library work. However, I had evidently made some impression on the library school people, And when one of my teachers, who had had me in three courses, wanted to go to Europe a particular year, she insisted that I was the person who had the notes and the triple experience that was needed to take her course. And so I was invited to teach at Columbia. While there, of course, I began to associate with C.C. Williamson, who was the head of the library as well as dean of the library school. Williamson was a very remarkable man. He was the pet, if you will, of the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundation, and had in some ways been used to clean up the situation at Columbia, as well as to start the library school there.
When you say clean up, do you mean that there was an unsatisfactory situation?
Well, the Columbia Library, and this is part of my experience, the Columbia Library had been an orphan. Nicholas Murray Butler had never really gone in much for library work in the first almost 25 years of his headship of that university. He thought the students ought to use the New York Public Library and that they ought to use the New York Academy of Medicine and the New York Historical Society and the like. However, with the Depression and other problems, and with the growth in the number of students, it became clear, even to Butler, that something had to be done. Besides, he began to see that he could do things through a university library that he couldn't do through those other institutions. Meantime, he'd got some Harkness oil money, and with that had built, or planned to build, although this hadn't come out yet, planned to build what is now called the Butler Library. This changed his attitude toward libraries, and he began to see that he had to do a special job at Columbia on libraries, which he proceeded with great skill and much money to do. I came in at the time when Williamson finally was being given a free hand to develop a much more remarkable library than he had earlier. And I became his assistant to the director, in charge of back-of-the-scenes work, cataloging and classification, although I continued to teach in the library school, and my hours during those years were something like 60 to 65 a week on the job. I also took a little history work under Commager and Sitwell, over in the history department, was accepted as a graduate student in history. But what with the job and the teaching, I was only an ordinary history student in the three courses, I believe, that I took. One was in historiography, in which I found that I was very much helped by my library back. However, in the meantime, had come to the attention of Quincy Mumford of the New York Public Library, who was on leave at that time from the New York Public Library, and in Washington helping Archibald MacLeish change, and again this was a question of clean up, the Library of Congress after 40 years of Herbert Putnam. There was nothing wrong with Putnam except that he got old. And the library world changed and he didn't. MacLeish came in, having been told by Roosevelt that all he needed to do was to spend the time he was shaving to work out the problems of the Library of Congress. MacLeish came in and did not only his shaving time, but a tremendous amount of personal time and energy on the change of the Library of Congress, Mumford being one of his principal workers in this. Mumford, however, needed a man who would do the order and cataloging work, and as I was doing that at Columbia, and he thought successfully, he asked me down. We had some remarkable interviews over a course of a day or two, and I saw a lot of the Library of Congress, which seemed to every librarian at that time the apogee of what you could try for. I went to Washington and took the job of head of ordering books.
Now, what year was this?
For the Library of Congress. We have now got up to 1940. 1940, of course, was a year when the war in Europe was on the start. Oh, it was a phony war almost at that time. But the American librarians were very worried about their book orders. At Columbia, I had paid no attention to any war problems, but had gone on wildly ordering books, in a hurry even, in order to get what we could in time. The experience back in 14 to 18 had been that by saving things in Germany, you got them bombed, or burned up, I believe it was, in a railroad fire at Leipzig, the book center there. And so we determined, at least I determined, that the thing to do was to get the books, even if a few of them did sink by submarine, get the books over in a hurry and not risk having them bombed in Germany. This was one of the things that attracted Mumford and Archibald MacLeish to me. And one of the things I did the minute I got to the Library of Congress was to go into a tremendous flurry of ordering things from Europe. The Library of Congress, of course, was immediately swept up in war work, and I had a dozen or so bouts with people in Washington on indexing classified film, for instance, which was taken during combat in order to make training films and, of course, intelligence reports. I did a great deal of research work in the Library of Congress, even though I was running a department, incidentally, for the Office of War Information. I also, of course, was watching the largest library in the United States at that time in a convulsion under a new program, a new administration, which was trying to change it from an American library of great power, but nevertheless still only an American library, into a world library, which it has since magnificently become. And I was part of the early shock troop that went in and worked there. However, my wife, who had now two children, found that neither Maryland nor Virginia was a place that she wanted to raise a family. She did not like the schools there at all, and she did not like, in general, the people whom she met there. And so she was telling me, in no uncertain terms, I was going to have to do something else. One day, shortly after D-Day, and I and everybody else understood that it was before D-Day because it was in February 1944. I had a visit from a man named Elliot, President Edward C. Elliot of Purdue. Elliot told me that he had asked Bruce Rogers, the famous book designer, how to locate a librarian. Rogers introduced him at the Harvard Club in New York to a man named Metcalf, who was librarian of Harvard. And Metcalf said that he thought that I would be one of a group that Elliot ought to see. Elliot did see others, but when he saw me, he wanted me to come out to Purdue. And I came out to Purdue with my wife in the middle of one of the best snowstorms we've ever had in West Lafayette. This was in February. My wife said she thought West Lafayette was a good place to raise children. My own evaluation of the library situation here, both by checking up on it from others and by looking at it myself, was that it was a mess. I wound up my affairs at the Library of Congress in about 4 months. They they all kidded me about going to Purdue. That it was something of a mystery to most of them why I was going to Purdue. I made it pretty clear why, but they didn't believe me. However, I did come to Purdue in August 1944. This was a dramatic experience. One, finding a house, two, living without an automobile. And I felt almost as though, what with the war conditions here, food and otherwise, that we had almost slipped back into the 1918s. I'd remembered a little of World War I, and I was very unhappy the first few months I was at Purdue. However, Eliot was a man who seemed to get along with me, and I got along with him. He told me he was, again, much more impressed with my 7 years with the New York Telephone Company than he was with any of my library experience. This seemed to mean a great deal to him as an administrator. However, I kept continually insisting that his library was a scandal. And he asked me once why I came here. This was about 6 months after. And I told him I came here because Purdue had no place to go but up.
And why was it a scandal?
Well, Purdue was an institution of 6,000 students at the time, and it had a faculty who, while they were not what I would call scholars, were an extremely clever, able, polished group of professional men.
Professional engineers and professional scientists.
Men who worked as consultants for big companies and who wanted the latest information and who wanted that information the way an industrialist would want that information, not as a scholar would want it, or in some senses not as a researcher would want it, but as a user of information would want it. And I told Eliot that one of the models I would have, probably, as a director of libraries here, would be to try and set up a special library, an industrial-type library, for the university, rather than a large academic historical library. And he was enthusiastic in his approval of this idea. He did two or three remarkable things when I first came here that encouraged me. When I came, I found that the staff had not signed contracts. At that time, one signed annual contracts. The staff had not signed their contracts because they'd not had a raise in pay. I began ferreting around to find out why there had been no raise in pay. Raises in pay at that time, just after the Depression, were not as automatic as they are in our time now. And so I worked through all the sources, both the staff, they told me their story, and through the financial people who told me their story as to why this had been. It had been an administrative mess, another administrative mess, no question about that. What had happened was, and this is a mark on Eliot, I feel, what had happened was that my predecessor Hepburn and Eliot had not seen eye to eye. Hepburn was a gentleman and a scholar, himself a very, very remarkably educated man. But he was not much of an administrator, and he was completely out of sympathy with Eliot. For example, he deliberately and continually used all surplus money in buying books for the English department, who no doubt were abused as far as funds go, but whose scholarship and whose participation and value to the university, I had to agree with Eliot, were minimal. And if you were going to put your money in the library where your power as a university was, you shouldn't put it in the English department.
I remember these gentlemen, because I came here in in 46, as nice people with master's degrees who most of them who devoted themselves to correcting papers and comma splicing.
I don't doubt that they were excellent teachers of composition.
They were.
I don't doubt that in many cases they had quality. Professor Creek, head of the English department, I always thought was a charming man, and in some ways an essayist.
He was a promising scholar.
He was a promising scholar. Two or three others in the department were obviously people who wanted to study and who wanted to work, but who didn't produce. Now, what this meant was that the university was really having a library that was unrelated to its program. So what could I do? Eliot, when I finally found out the facts about the raise in the library salaries, or the lack of raise in library salaries, I went to Eliot's office and told him that the librarian should have a raise, because what had happened was that Hepburn had, in his budget proposal, said that if anybody else at the university gets a raise, the librarian should have them. He had not, however, entered any specific raises in the budget sheet. This, it seemed to me, of course, indicated that he was not an administrator. This was a sort of a that minimal thing that an administrator must do, namely ask outright for what he wants, but had only asked by implication. Well, when I pointed this out to Eliot, and Eliot frankly confessed that what he had done is said that if Hepburn wasn't going to name any budget increases for his staff, certainly it wasn't up to him as president to move in and name salary increases for people whom he didn't know and didn't supervise directly. So I told Eliot that I thought there should be. I had not known the library staff too well, but nevertheless they looked like good people to me, and they should have increases if other people had, and I wanted them to get them. Well, he said, all right, he said, I will give them to you when you can tell me how good they are and what the increases will be. When will that be? And I thought, my gosh, I'm talking facts and figures with this man, so I'll name a date. I said, October 1st. He said, fine. I said, well, now, I said, I have to go back and speak to the librarian, so I'd like that in writing. Whereby Eliot's jaw did fall. He looked at me for a minute or two, and I looked back at him. I said, these women know you, and they know you'll keep your word. They don't know me. I'm a brand new thing to them. Now, I said, if I go back with a written statement from you, we may have some effect. But I said, if I don't, I don't know what will happen. Well, he said, all right, and called Miss Blagrave in, dictated a memorandum to her, and said that he would consider raises if I came into his office on the 1st of October with recommendations.
And evaluations.
And evaluations. I therefore went back to the library with this letter, insisted that each professional member of the staff read it in my office and initial it to show that they had read it. Most of them accepted it. However, a chief person, Rachel Schenck, blew up at this, cried wildly in my office, and said she was insulted. After a very emotional scene, she wanted to know if she could go and see President Eliot. And I thought if anybody wanted to go and see President Eliot, they could. And I said she should, which she did. Eliot's called me up and said, what is she talking to me about? All she's done is sob. And I said, I think she's telling you her feelings have been hurt. He said, well, I can't help that. And I said, I appreciate that, but I said, her feelings have been hurt and I think she's going to resign. He said, well, what does she plan to do? I said, I don't know. However, Miss Schenck did resign. She was head of the circulation department and probably the smartest woman on the staff in many ways, if not unquestionably. She went up to Wisconsin and became head of the library school there for something like 18 years after she got a master's degree from the University of Chicago, and was always a very good friend of mine, sent me many excellent people as employees for the library in subsequent years. She never held anything against me, but she never forgave Eliot. It was, I think, a question of a long period of feeling that the library, Miss Schenck's feeling, that the library had never been appreciated. Now, I think that the problem was, in many ways, Eliot's problem. He, if I can look back over Eliot, he thoroughly understood what a great university's plant, its physical setting, should be. In fact, I think he probably, in some ways, almost single-handedly rammed through a remarkable building program at the university. And as he himself said, stuck his neck out wisely and well to make Purdue physically an important place. Personally, Eliot was a superb academic technician. There was almost nothing he didn't know about academic work and how it ought to be done. I myself never felt that he was sympathetic with it, however. To him, being president of Purdue was more or less a job, which he did with great gusto. But whether he loved scholarship, whether he even loved research, I have very grave doubts. He started out as a chemist, of all things, and then went into school work, which seems to me to indicate something about him. I think he felt he knew how to move people around, but he didn't really feel that he could understand ideas, I suspect, nor the kind of concepts that lead a research man deeper and deeper into nature or the intellectual problems of mankind. These were not Eliot's allegiances. He certainly knew how to put on a show about these things. He could give a good talk, and one of his great values to the university, I'm sure, was his relationship with other institutions, with the big foundations in the East, with a government in Indianapolis. I think he was superb with the Indiana legislature. Herman Wells.
Would you go so far as to say that he was on an intellectual level with many of the people in the state whom he met?
He was, and cleverer than they. Herman Wells told me that old President Bryan of Indiana University never trusted Eliot. Wells told me that. Wells himself said that he felt that Eliot would do what was for his own good, and if your good happened to go along with it, Eliot was perfectly willing to have you prosper too. And that he himself, in the few years that their terms overlapped, determinedly went into the Indiana legislature each 2 years, arm in arm, and allowed no breakthrough by splitting them up, breakthrough in reducing the rising academic budget. The other powerful people here when I first came were R.B. Stewart and a man named Hockema. R.B. Stewart was unquestionably first class.
Now let us identify Stewart. He was not vice president at the time.
No, he was called controller.
Controller. And Hakama, who has been a former Buick salesman and closely, intimately related with General Motors, was what?
He was the president's doorman.
Didn't he have a title of vice president for academic affairs?
Not yet. Not yet. That didn't come until later. And I think there's a little story there that is important. When I first came, Hakama was simply a man who you saw first before you saw Elliot. He never was a vice president in 44 or 45. I think Elliot was kind of upset when the trustees insisted that he leave at 70. And didn't continue him as a wartime emergency or something like that. However, he never made anything of this publicly. An acting president, Andre Potter, came in, and I was tremendously pleased with a man we always called Dean Potter. He was dean of the engineering school and was a remarkable engineer personally, professionally, and a remarkable human person in dealing with people and in working with individuals good. I'm always pleased to see this in an engineer, and Dean Potter was this above all things. Half a dozen times I went to him in the 6 months that he was the president of the university. Each time resulted in very happy affairs. He gave me good advice. He helped me with individual situations. I never had to ask him for money. I don't know what would have happened. However, here is where Mr. Stewart, the controller, proved to be a great help. He realized, I think because of his knowledge of comparable academic situations, the parlous condition of the Purdue libraries. He insisted to me at a dinner once that he had $1 million to build me a library, which was a charming statement for him to make. And he deliberately threw funds to the library's book fund when he had spare money. I apologized for bothering him about some book purchases, because I said they really were intellectual matters, and he acted, I think he was amused, but he said, you know, I am interested in intellectual things too. And I realized I possibly had insulted him, but I don't think you ever insulted him if he wanted, unless he wanted to have you, and then he'd use the situation one way or another. He was, however, I think a colossal egoist, no question about that, but I always felt that he was on the side of the angels.
But frequently is beneficial to the institution.
He was, and I've got to really point out how remarkable this was in a certain situation later on. When Hovde came, he made one tour through the library and pronounced it a lost cause, which of course was nothing I could argue with him about, and I never had to. He always assumed the library was no good, which I enthusiastically seconded during each of my budget hearings.
May I ask you a question about that? Were our budgets unusually small in comparison to other Big Ten schools and in comparison to schools like it in the United States?
Our budgets were terrible in comparison in 1944, and our budgets went back historically to 1920. I did a table once to show at budget hearings in which I showed that Purdue's budget had gaps as much as $500,000 below institutions like Illinois, when Purdue had almost as many students as Illinois, and that Wisconsin and Minnesota and other institutions had always larger and larger budgets, and cumulatively, and Purdue's gap was cumulatively gross over the years.
This would seem that the trustees and those who made the budgets were anti-intellectual, or rather anti-library. Is this true?
I think that it wasn't anything active. It was just that there had never been any demand about the library.
That is the demand coming from the faculty and students.
And the students. There had just never been any gripes or complaints about the library from either faculty or students.
I know precisely what you mean, because I remember one department head who had a department of over 20 men and had a budget of around $3,500, and who spent half of that one year in getting a set of special books which he kept in his office.
This was typical of the indifference. It wasn't anti. I never really ran into any feeling against the library. And as I worked in order to understand the nature of the institution and to ride with the nature and the institution with what techniques libraries have, and they do have some, I found by indirection that I was constantly being told, we don't want you to take our books away from us and put them over in a big library. This was the standard line, and it was never said with very much crankiness, but just with a sort of a sadness about what's the matter with you librarians that always want to grab the books in and not let us have them.
Does this lead to your building, then, of departmental libraries?
It does. It does. You see, I had never had any idea of crowding materials in, because at Columbia it was clear to me that a powerful law faculty wasn't going to allow law books in the general library, and a powerful medical faculty wasn't going to allow medical books at the general library, and they didn't. Centralized though Columbia and Yale and the other institutions claimed they were, in fact, any part of the institution that had a really powerful faculty or really powerful professional group had their own libraries. Therefore, it seemed to me, both because of the actual impossibility of doing anything else with a small central building, that the way was to set up rooms, and this is all they were, rooms in various buildings around the campus. For instance, chemistry already had one, although they had it in such an administrative basis that it didn't report to the general library, and in a way its book budget wasn't very much under control of the general library. And it was almost 5 or 7 years before the book budget and the personnel in the chemistry library, departmental library, came under the general library. It took at least another 4 or 5 years beyond that, something like 8 or 10 years, before the library in the Ag Experiment Station was moved to become a part of the general library. So there was this strong resistance to a big general library at the university. Consequently, I moved as rapidly as possible, and sometimes almost against my own conscience, to set up small departmental libraries. These were sometimes so small they were no good, and I knew it, but there was very little else I could do about it. It was a no good departmental library, or no departmental library, or no interest on the department's part about libraries. And so the lesser of the evils was something you always chose. An administrator has to be a very practical man if he's to be a good administrator. The alternate, of course, is to resign and walk off in a huff. I never was able to enjoy that particular kind of emotional luxury, and so I did the best I could. The departmental libraries, uneven though they were, nevertheless did develop. And of all things, it was the chemistry library, which had an angel in the name of Guy Mellon within the department. He taught the course in the literature of chemistry with great skill. He wrote books on the retrieval of chemical information, and he fostered the library. In fact, he planned it. Actually, he planned the chemistry library completely, except for one point, when I found out he was going to have a book elevator in which you lifted books off a truck and put it on a little hand elevator. I suggested that he have a truck elevator, which would save a lot of motion and time. This, he nodded, and the next thing I knew, the plans included a truck elevator. But nevertheless, Professor Mellon was always a strong general library backer as well as a chemistry library backer, and was one of the first people who I felt became a research man at Purdue interested in libraries. Other people slowly came on. Lark Horowitz in physics was interested, although the physics library never began as one room, became two, but it never became what it should be until just within weeks now. Nevertheless, he wanted a library and a librarian there, and he worked very hard to get it. The aeronautical people, who at that time were way out at the airport, also wanted it. And pretty soon it became practice to have a library, and while some of them never did flourish, in general, we came from about two departmental libraries when I came here to 22.
That includes the libraries in the engineering school, too?
There are five libraries in the engineering schools. Some of them are still what I consider scandals as far as book control and other things. But nevertheless, when you realize that the Krannert Library occupies two floors of the Krannert Building, this is perhaps an outstanding library development.
And as I understand also that math has one of the finest libraries of its kind in the United States.
The math library, of course, is a tribute also to a research mathematician who was also a library advocate, and that is A.H. Smith. Professor Smith purchased with great skill right from the beginning of my time here. Whenever I had funds, he was there instantly showing me how they could be used for subject matter, and of course I enthusiastically accepted it, because while you know you ought to buy a technological and scientific material for a Purdue institution, a librarian is not necessarily the best person. Take in civil engineering. I know we have eight fields of civil engineering here. There are perhaps as many as 15 fields of civil engineering. Consequently, you don't buy all civil engineering. You try and buy the fields that you need. Sometimes only the individuals can tell you what to buy, and if you can get them hooked into your purchasing, you're way ahead in helping them. But the balance between the librarian, the bibliographer, the active scholar is a triumvirate that never will settle. It never going to freeze. If one becomes active, the other is weakened and sometimes discouraged, and this has to each have to encourage the other.
I notice you're talking about libraries. You do not talk about what later became the School of Humanities, Social Science, and Education in the sense of departmental libraries. Was that a special case in any way?
Well, around the United States, it is commonly felt that the tremendous growth in size, and it was a remarkable growth, tripling and quadrupling of libraries, was due to the documentation that became available in the social sciences, and to some extent the import and gradual world interest of the humanities. As long as you're merely going to have English literature in a college library, the humanities collection isn't necessarily very large. But if you begin to try and cover world literature, such as Illinois and Wisconsin and Minnesota do, typically out here, and Harvard and Yale have always done in the East, you get a tremendous volume of material. Well, it was the beginning around 1910 and going up to about 1950, it was the gradual attempt of these libraries in the Big Ten and the great universities generally to become world holders of all universal literature in the humanities and the social sciences that made them so big. The actual physical volumes in their physics libraries and their chemistry libraries and their engineering libraries were never very large, and actually Purdue's departmental libraries are often as big as Michigan's.
What I'm interested in is the attitude of so many scientists and engineers. They use the abstracts, whereas the social scientist needs the book or the entire set or the run of the serial. And these people are always amazed at the fact that the people in the social sciences, sociology, history, and English cannot use abstracts.
Why, you see, an abstract has no quality at all for a sociologist. It doesn't tell him all the shades of concern and lack of concern. It doesn't tell him what his fellow worker has chosen to ignore. If you decide you're going to ignore the black and white question and write a sociology of the United States, it's possible to do that if you insist on doing it. But it's not probably a very good history of the United States sociologically.
Since Purdue has, as our trustees say, a unique mission, which is directed towards industry and science, did it make any wrench in policy or change in policy when after World War II, the social sciences and humanities suddenly demanded all of the books that
the
were ever published?
The social science and humanities did not demand the books. Now, let me finish. I know you're one of them, but let me finish the story because it's an important story. After the humanities came in, I kept reading the catalog and reading what they said they were doing, and going to the president in annual budget hearings and in other times when I could get his ear, and telling him what this involved. I got nothing except complete blandness, always very polite, attentive.
I mean, it's sort of like sin. You can't be for sin.
No.
Must be for good libraries and progressive ideas.
But the statement was always made, they'll have to go and use Indiana's, or they'll have to go and use the Chicago libraries. Yeah. This was the statement that was made. The fact that they were suddenly setting up seminars in which students were doing papers that had to be turned in 2 or 3 months, and this kind of thing has to be done with local resources, never was understood at the top. And it was not understood at the top of HE, HSSE.
You are, let us be specific, you're referring to Dean Ayers and then to Dean Ogle or both?
I'm referring to both. As a matter of fact, in some way, Dean Ayers was more concerned about getting cash for the library than Dean Ogle. But the point I'm going to make about Dean Ogle, I think, has to go on the record. We were greatly pleased in the library when the faculty were reorganized, a senate was set up, and a library committee was set up. The first year of the library committee was a very remarkable one in that it consisted of about 8 or 10 whaling sessions, all of which were sad in themselves, and all of which were concerned almost exclusively with humanities.
Now that means then that the humanities were complaining, we do not have a budget.
Yeah.
We do not have the books to carry on undergraduate or graduate research.
Well, they kept saying graduate research, although they did not know what they meant by graduate research. The humanities have never had that number of PhD candidates that would to make tremendous forays on libraries. However, they have done department does. They have set up these seminars in which they ask students to do preliminary and survey reviews of the literature. You set up a seminar in the history of China, and here we have 6 or 7 shelves of books on China, and some of the people in the seminar, if it consists of 10 or 15 students, some of the people in the seminar aren't going to have any material to work with. You have a political science department that sets up a seminar on international relations, and they start working on the Falkland Islands, and the university here has nothing whatever from Argentina's point of view at all. You may get something from the London Times, and you may get something from the British Sessional Papers, but all on microfilm, but you don't get anything on microform. But you don't get anything from the legislature, I don't know the name of the legislature, Buenos Aires. You don't get any foreign papers. We don't have any of the Argentinian blue, green, yellow, or whatever books were issued, and there were some issued. You don't get any of these things, and these are the things the students need if they're going to do any kind of a paper. Now, this is not, quote, research. This is learning. Where what the topography of your field is, and where there might be research opportunities. This is not research, but we didn't have these resources to begin with.
And you had had the kind of library in which the professor assigns 3 books a semester, and the books written in 1908 when he was a graduate student are sufficiently good.
He is sure this is what the student should use. Now, the way this came out, however, after the committee had heard the wailing, the committee was not stupid. They had a number of brilliant men on it, and then I use the word carefully. And they demanded that the vice president, and by this time it was Vice President Cheena, come over and talk to them, and that Dean Ogle and his assistant deans come over and talk to them. At this time, the vice president told them that the funds were not there and wouldn't be there, and they wouldn't notice any difference in the library probably for 5 or 7 years. I thought he was underestimating it, but it was a realistic statement in a way. Dean Ogle made the statement that he hadn't been very much concerned about the library up to then. Well, this was a real knockaroo, because it seemed to me almost institutional ineffectiveness of the worst possible sort to start a program as expansive and with the deliberate intent of having the doctorate in 14 or 15 different fields. It seemed to me completely off base.
Now, may I stop you there just to be clear on the record? Dean Ogle's attitude was that you would have a PhD, but you didn't need a research library to do it.
That you could wait until you got a research library.
And let the PhD go on anyway.
Yeah, but of course, the thing I always remember is when they gave the first PhD in sociology, we were told that, of course, this would, we really would do survey work and we wouldn't need very much materials, and of course we ought to borrow the materials from other libraries.
Or we have the interlibrary
loan.
CIC as well as loan.
Oh yes, this was pointed out.
Now the CIC, for the record, is what?
The Committee on Interinstitutional Cooperation of the Big Ten.
Yes.
And it's an informal but nevertheless active agency among those institutions. Well, with traveling scholars was the idea. Well, the first person that got a PhD in sociology from Purdue was a Norwegian. And when that guy went back to Norway, what he knew about Italian, German, or even British sociology, as far as their literature and the resources that they ought to, he ought to check, that guy couldn't possibly have known any of those things. It was one of the, I think, an example of the unrealistic nature. Now, in defense of Dean Ogle and other people, it's a good question of how you do this. Do you wait 15 or 20 years and spend $500,000 a year for that time and then give a doctorate finally? Or do you give a doctorate and consider other tricks, such as using other institutions' resources? I myself have not found that either of these things worked. One, the responsibility for the slow development of the library was not accepted by the faculty people. One, this was not bought as a need, and or actively sponsored as a need. And two, I have not found that the students were being sent around to other institutions. Now, the reason what I base this on is the fact that I have always worked very hard with other institutions cooperatively, and have known most of the heads of the 60, 70, 100 academic institutions in the United States. I've always stood ready and have done on occasion a letter and done it on occasion to these people, introducing a Purdue person. I don't think I have done 30 of those in 15 years.
You wrote a very nice letter to the director of the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris for me.
Well,
I remember that.
I'm glad to, and those people always appreciate having somebody introduced to them, because they want to be generous, but they want to be sure that they're doing it for the right persons and not for anybody. However, to be a little more systematic about this, the library did, from about 1940 to about 1960, develop a remarkable collection of scientific and technical material, periodicals for people like Mellon and people like Smith and others joined in on this. In other words, the engineering and the science and the ag people, biology, worked very hard in the choice of literature and getting materials here, and the president supported successive increases in the budget. Now, these were successive increases. There was never a great jump. This was always a 10%, but it was always by the library staff moved entirely into the periodical budget. We bought minimally in textbooks, we bought minimally in treatises, because in the scientific and technical fields these age so rapidly, and they are they obsolesce a half a dozen years on the very year they're published. It's like a new car. So the library really had, by 1960, an adequate collection of current intellectual materials in the sciences and technology. Then, of course, the doctorates began to be approved in the social sciences and in the humanities. I was called over to Gina's office, and we had quite a discussion about this around, I think it was in 1962. I told him what I thought the facts of library life were. I was quite rough, and he was quite frank. I insisted that it was ridiculous to go out and pay, at that time, it seems small now, pay $20,000, $25,000 for a first-class sociologist, a first-class historian, a first-class individual, and to bring him to Purdue and never make any arrangements for his library materials. I told him that at other institutions, individuals in those fields, going to the University of Chicago, for example, I had knew of a man who went there in an established field and wanted a six-figure special appropriation for his literature, the literature he was going to require. And I told him this was the way it was done in the big time, and that the way we were doing it at Purdue was all wrong. I know that this must have got to him, because at the next budget hearing, President Hovde complained that he was being cheated. His point was, they tell me, we can start a very fine study area here if you'll just give us the $20,000 for this professor's salary. And he said, they never tell me then that you're going to come in 3 months and tell me I need $250,000 for books and space.
Well, you would almost believe that a first-class university would take the idea, if you have a good man, you must give him the books. I know UCLA employed a friend of mine at about $20,000 to start and gave him a budget of $75,000 for his own research purposes the first year. In
well,
other words,
this
it cost him around, let's say, $100,000 the first year to have this man. Purdue does not do that.
Purdue does not do that.
Is this because of the method of bookkeeping or because of the vision of the Purdue administrators?
I would say it was because of the vision. I honestly feel, and this is an indictment, I honestly feel that in some ways Purdue has sneaked in by the back door into the humanities area.
Well, I was rather under the impression humanities were created by the student demand.
Well, I would say that the justification of your statement there is another aspect of the
I'm
same thing.
I'm thinking of the Department of Philosophy, for example.
Well, unquestionably. And I think everybody has been a participant in this, in the sense of being guilty. Here you have these physical quarters all available. Here you have this program all going. It's all paid for by the state already. Here you have these state students who can't get admitted to Illinois or can't pay the higher fees at Illinois. So we've got to go someplace. Well, Indiana University is completely filled up. Well, where can we go? Well, there's Purdue sitting. It can take more students. Let's go to Purdue. Well, they don't want to study engineering in order to go to Purdue. They want to study something else. And Purdue does have to have, because of the requirements of the Engineering Council for Professional Development, Purdue does have to have a humanistic STEM. Well, let's expand the humanistic STEM. But expand is the cheating word there. We'll take in a lot of students, but expand it just a little. In other words, we'll load the students in and try and do as little more as possible. Now, the state is a party to this because the state is constantly telling, budget-wise, telling the institution, no new programs, no new programs, no new programs. We can't afford any new programs. But the institution then, of course, has to get in a program under an old name. Well, you don't suddenly have a program going, say, in history for $100,000 a year. You don't suddenly have that $300,000 the next year. This is in an institution which is getting a 5 or 7% increase in budget. This just doesn't happen. Well, the institution had been getting more money for students and, in a way, for in fees. And I discovered that from 1956 till about 1961 or two, actually the library was getting less than its 5, 6, or 7% that was coming. Beginning with Vice President Cheney, we got our percentage, sometimes 2 or 3% more than the rest of the institution's general growth from the state. Now, Cheney had me over, and after this round in which we had an understanding about what the humanities involved, he offered me $150,000 to build up the library for the humanities, and he said he wanted very remarkable progress. And then he said, how much progress can you guarantee me? Well, we were then spending about $300,000 a year for periodicals and other things, and so I told him, well, about 6 months, at which time he got up from his chair, walked up down the room, and cursed and swore. I think partly at me, but that was neither here nor there. I went back to the library staff, and I told them, here, we're going to have to spend $150,000 with the same staff. He isn't increasing the staff at all. And I said, shall I tell him to keep his $150,000 and tell him we can't do it, or what will we do? Well, being professional librarians and being concerned with the educational utility of the place and realizing that the books are the most important thing that we have, they all voted to take the money, and they'd squeeze the work through out of their operations. Well, they did. However, when you do this, you always pay in the long run. Unquestionably, I have always had the philosophy based on the sciences and technology that professions take care of their own literature retrieval. What do I mean by this? Well, the chemists back in 1906 decided there had to be a chemical abstract service, and now it has grown to be something like a $10 million a year operation. The physicists and the others have done that. The ag people, of course, have had the U.S. Department of Agriculture Services to take care of those. The medical people have had the National Library of Medicine now, the National Library of Medicine's retrieval tools to use. But nobody has ever done this in any serious way for the humanists or the social scientists. They have never had this kind of tool. And so they have turned to the library, the local library, the local academic library, to do this for them. Well, my cataloging and back of the scenes work had always been based upon minimal description and maximum dependence upon chemical abstracts, physics abstracts, and the others. Well, with this new growth and this new literature coming in, this system was not adequate. However, an adequate system would have required a tripling of the back of the scenes staff in order to even start to do the detailed work that was required, and nobody wanted to do this. Much as I explained it to everybody, whenever there was a choice between more book funds and doing more processing, the answer was always, well, let's buy the books. And so the processing has gotten less and less adequate. However, it seems to me this is a national problem too, because I really feel that the processing has got to change. The library system, which is now almost 100 years old, it started with Cutter at the Smithsonian in 1854 on cards, and I do think the cataloging card system is antique. And I've always hated to recommend a tremendous expansion of it when I feel that some kind of, popular word today is computer, but some kind of technological improvement processing ought to go through rather than...
You're getting into cybernetics now.
Yes, you are. Throwing all your money.
And retrieval.
However, when I come to departments to talk about this, in words of one syllable, I don't get very much appreciation or understanding, and I'll give an example. Spanish department did not like the way the Spanish books were classified on our shelves, and the Dewey Decimal System is not too adequate for Spanish material. It mixes up South American material, and it divides authors by form. If a man writes a novel, it's in under one number. If he writes a play, it's under another number. And usually, the technique of studying today is by a period and then by a total literary figure, rather than by formal the particular genre that the literature is in. Well, they wanted to reclassify. Well, I suggested that we computerize the thing, because if you did that, you would be able to do much more. For instance, you could develop the concept of honor in Spanish novels or plays and the like. You could develop all kinds of organization of the Golden Age and inheritors of it, as well as those that were active during it, and the dissenters in it. You could show those that were throwbacks to previous primitive forms in Spanish literature. Yeah, you could show foreign influences, the French influence, the Moorish influence, this kind of thing, could all be brought out. But, of course, this would take a remarkable amount of thesaurus work and would take a real analysis of the material, the pieces of the material, in order to bring this out. Well, the people to do this, obviously, were the faculty. They were supposedly the students who knew the literature. We could help them with all kinds of technical assistance. Well, that idea was not tolerable. That couldn't be accepted. And so what we've done is just change the numbers on the back of the books from one kind of number to another kind of number, which is following the University of Illinois system, which is 60 years old. And I don't think they've won a bit. I think they've spent $15,000-$18,000, and I don't think anybody has any intellectual leap.
Of course, one thing that you have, in talking about these and these problems, the one thing that you haven't told us, and I'd like to get on the record, is to what extent, just in straight numbers, did the library grow during your 25 years of administration?
Well, the library grew from 186,000 volumes to a million volumes. On December 6th, theoretically, and actually we had a million volumes. We may have had a million and 22, we may have had a million and 200. It depended on how many were delivered that day. But we passed the million figure in last December. More important than the numbers, of course, is what these were. We don't keep track of these too well, but I'm sure that something like 300,000 or 400,000 of those are periodical bound volumes.
May I go off the tape for a moment? All right, we're now back on the tape. Excuse me for interrupting.
No. We had 300, at least 300,000 to 400,000 of those are periodical volumes. which is very unusual. The contents of most academic libraries of a million volumes would probably be 50 or 60,000 periodicals. Now, this represents the if you will, the thrust or bias of our collection in the sciences and technologies. Now, for instance, I don't think we have more than 150 to 200,000 volumes in what you would call the social sciences. Now, in most institutions, this would be
Well, they would have the collection of sources, the monumenta, and the archives, mm-hmm. and the legislative mm-hmm. records, and so mm-hmm. on, of all the countries.
Now, the other thing we have done, both for the sciences and the humanities, and the social sciences, we have bought in microform in the last 10 years, voluminously, and we have now we had no microform at all the year I got here. We now have some 300,000 bibliographical items on microform. Now, we have systematically bought those items that had retrieval built into them. That they had their own index. It's like the London Times has its own index.
Of course, may I say that you have been, and go on record, a most distinguished advisor and helper to the American Microform Academy, which is dedicated to the use of microform for scholarly purposes. While I am president of the Academy, I must pay this tribute to you and your assistance.
Thank you. But this has been a necessity, and on the whole, it's in line with the national trend. I mean, Purdue hasn't been queer in this way. Most of the catch-up institutions around the country have bought these same sets, and most of the great institutions have added them too, even though they may have had three-quarters of the originals, because the originals are in all kinds of dilapidation and in all kinds of inadequacy. For instance, Professor Erickson, when he did the British Sessional Papers, found that nobody had the perfect set. Illinois didn't have it, nor did the House of Commons.
And as a matter of fact, the only perfect set is the one that he edited,
this
for microprint.
Has more in it than anybody else. So Purdue has built up a collection of these and has very useful resources, and none of these are mistakes. These will be of use for an indefinite period. None of this will have to ever be thrown out, so to speak. Now, I do want to mention the fact that the building, the physical quarters, I think we've been talking about the collection and the community, if you will. The administration, now the building. There never was any question in the president's mind there had to be a new library building. The question was how. Indiana University, of course, our sister institution, built a library around 1900, and its collection had gone almost to 2 million, and it still was in horrible quarters, and one of these recently burned up with the loss of $500,000 worth of books. Before they just now, as of 1970, moved into a new building. However, back in 54, their condition was incredibly bad, and Purdue's was just about as bad, and the state legislature showed no interest in this whatever. The whole drive then was to build more classrooms in order to take care of the veterans' bulge and the student enrollments. The classrooms, not libraries. So I must pay this tribute to R.B. Stewart. At the time, there was a drive on to develop the center of the campus. He knew there had to be a memorial center or a center for activity there, and the library happened to be right in the critical spot. There was talk that the library might go out near the airport, or that it might go up near the stadium. I always resisted this vigorously on the basis that the library ought to be where the people would stumble over it as they went around the campus. So I was offering no warmth or any alternatives. And he, in the meantime, went ahead with his ideas of financing. He was going to finance a tremendous number, 35 or 40 meeting rooms. He also had the gift of money from the Loebs of a performing arts theater. And with these sums, which he estimated might be $4 million, $5 million, he was wondering how he was going to take care of a library. Actually, he once proposed that there be a front built of these meeting rooms, and back of these there would be a performing arts theater, and a big hole in the middle would be for a library, in order to shame the Indiana legislature into approving $3 or $4 million for it. This was in the early 50s. He thought this over and realized he wasn't going to shame the Indiana legislature into much. They don't shame easily. So he called me up one day and asked me if I would agree to manage reading rooms in a union. And I told him I was sure I could manage reading rooms in the union, but what was this all about? Because there was a reading room in the union, and I'd never wanted anything to do with it much. It was under the student control, and I thought it met the needs very well without paying a lot of money for supervision. So then he explained that he could write the bonding issue so as to include reading rooms as part of this memorial center.
And this would then become a library.
And then that I could use this in lieu of a library. And I told him enthusiastically, go ahead. And so we developed 3 acres of reading room. The whole top of the building, the whole attic, quote, of the building is library area. And here we come to something that's dear to my heart. The basement includes, besides student services and others, an adequate, it was in the 50s, very adequate, it was superior to anything in the Middle West and probably in the country, an adequate audiovisual center. And so this he proceeded to do and got some $10 million in bonds. And we developed then the library in the Memorial Center. This library would house about 800 or more thousand volumes, depending on you, how you crowded them, and it would seat 1,500 people. This was almost what the national service around the country was providing for people at that time, when the students were, particularly the veterans and their successors, were crowding in. Purdue in 1958, when the Memorial Center opened, and in 1960, when they redid the old building, gutted and redid the old building, Purdue's library was all right. It wasn't a superior library, but physically it met the academic needs quite well. Then, of course, 2 or 3 years later, with the introduction of the humanities and social sciences, of course, and the growing collection, it became increasingly less adequate because the engineers were studying at home or studying borrowed materials in their reading rooms and the like. The humanist wants to come in and browse. The library is not adequate for, particularly in view of the number of the humanities and social sciences students. And the need for a new library has, of course, been recognized by the Centennial fundraising.
Now, that library will be a general library, or will it be a library for undergraduates or for graduates, or what will it be for?
I have never been made privy to what the final decision will be. The official answer is that there is a planning committee at the faculty to work on it.
And yet, but the interesting thing is that we do not have a building on the campus that is only for libraries.
That is true.
That is true.
Now, you will, I think, find that a building that is only for libraries frequently keeps people away. the effort to walk to the library may well be more than some people will want to put in. To drop by the library on their way in or out of their work area, such as the mechanical engineering building, may be something else entirely. So I'm not at all sure that I'm not at all sure what the proper, what the maximum, the optimum library service should be. I'm afraid that it has to be both. President Hovde once accused me of running a centralized and a decentralized library with all the extravagances of both. And this is my temptation. I have a feeling that books have to be where the people are, and then if you demand that people come to where the books are, many won't come. They just won't come. So I am not at all satisfied that building a large central library maximizes the use of materials.
May I ask at this time, blow your own horn a moment, what do you consider to be the greatest thing you have done for the university since you've been here?
I would say the scientific periodical collection and the audiovisual center.
Very good.
The audiovisual center is a special case, and I was way out in left field to begin with. President Hovde had a committee, Elliot before him had a committee, studying what to do with all the new teaching equipment, teaching materials. This committee told the president at one time, President Hovde at one time, that he ought to spend something like $300,000 or $400,000, and after that statement he just got up and left the room and the committee were left sitting there. It was headed by a man named Judd Rising, who was a devotee of audiovisual work, although he was a professor of graphics, and there is some connection between his interests. Of course, kept sending reports to the president. The president kept ignoring them. And finally, the committee got antsy about this, and there was a decision between Jim Miles and myself that the first one who was in to see the president in the next budget hearing would tell him that the committee either wanted some money to do something or wanted to be dissolved. So we went in to see the president. I called up Jim. Jim went first that year. I called up Jim and asked him. He said, "Oh, Lord," he said, "they threw me off base the minute I got in there." And he said, "I was on the defensive ever since." And I didn't get a chance to speak of it. So when I was thrown off base, nevertheless, at the end of the library discussion, I told the president how the faculty felt about being ignored and their request and interest in audiovisual, and he said, "Well, what do you want?" I said, "Well, I think we could make a beginning with $25,000. He said, "I'll give you $15,000. I said, "Take." And I said, "I'll tell Professor Rising." "Oh, no," he said, "you won't tell Rising this." I said, "Well, Professor Rising's chairman of the committee." He said, "Well, you're going to administer the $15,000, or there's going to be no $15,000. Well, I said, "Then I think you better tell Professor Rising this." So he did. And the committee continued, but there was a unit started. This consisted of pulling together a film library, and I honestly think it was the semantic connection between a film library and library that got me involved into being called director of the Audiovisual Center. It consisted largely at first of a film library, but we then began to take on the making of motion picture films, which was an enormous undertaking, and we began to do a great deal of work with graphics.
And then the audiovisual developed from there.
Well, when we got into the new building, we were able to plan for adequate quarters, and then it really did blossom.
Yes.
It is still one of the best in the country. At the time, it was the most remarkable establishment there was.
Oh, I think so. I've used it to good purpose. Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you something personal before we wind up here, and we have some tape of the, we'll have in an appendix to the typescript, of course, a list of your honors and degrees and your curriculum vitae and so on. What honors would you, that you've had as chairman of national committees and working with, I know you've done a lot of work with the Association of Research Libraries, would you just put that on the tape of what you've done and honors you've received and so on?
Well, I think there have been two things that I've done that...
By the way, first, before that, I just happened to think of it, what was the title of your doctoral thesis?
That's something I've been wanting to straighten out ever since we started. Back in my days, the second 30 hours in library science didn't lead to the doctorate. My first professional degree after 30 hours of advanced work was a bachelor's degree. Again, I got a BLS. And then my next 30 hours led to a master's degree. I wrote a thesis for my master's degree, which was published finally by the New York Public Library in its bulletin. It was a study of the directory information available for New York City residents from 1626 to 1786, when the first formal directory for New York City was printed. And I was 54 pages of my work was published in the New York Public Library Bulletin, which was a great feather in my cap, particularly since it was published in the middle of World War II, 1942, it was finally published. Now, this, of course, has now been remedied. The library schools now have, Columbia now gives a doctorate of library science, Illinois gives a PhD and other schools. But at that time, the final degree was a master's degree in library science. I once toyed with getting a doctorate in history, but it was soon clear to me that it was either my career as administrator in libraries or I was going to have to give up and become an historian. And I had to feed two and then three children, so it was the library administration. Now, about the Association of Research Libraries. The Association of Research Libraries was really a club of the big librarians, big libraries around the United States, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Chicago, and California, this kind of thing, about 40 people. These were the heads of the libraries of the AAU, American Association of Universities. Purdue joined the AAU late, around the middle, late 40s, and then I finally became a member. The older libraries, of course, were primarily humanities libraries. Purdue, of course, was a science library. And while John Creerar was a member of this, it was an unusual thing to have science librarians. However, the Association of Research Libraries wanted to become something more than just a club. And one of the ways they wanted to do this was to get some money in order to set up a secretariat and have an office and become a real national organization. They looked around as to where this could be and found very few people interested in them, but they did get a nibble from NSF, National Science, NSF, National Science Foundation, the Office of Scientific Information. This group had some money and wanted to get science materials introduced into the academic world on a more respected basis than they had been. And there was this interest. Well, the NSF people asked for a committee, and I, Dix of Princeton, and myself, and I can't think of his name McAnally from Cornell, were the three members of this committee, and we worked with NSF for about 2 years. At the end of which time, they gave a grant of $85,000 to the Association of Research Libraries, and hired McAnally as secretary, so that the whole affair has now become a membership. Our dues at one time were $25; they are now $1,200, and they've added a number of extra institutions, so they have about $100,000 a year to maintain themselves as an organization, and they are doing a remarkable bit of work. I'm very much honored to have been one of the early workers. In the American Library Association, I've always been on the academic side, I was chairman of two or three efforts. I was chairman of a committee of agricultural libraries at one time, and I was chairman of another committee of agriculture and science libraries. Always consisted of the land grant group, primarily, although some others belonged, and never seemed to be quite at home in the American Library Association. And when I began to be involved in the building and other activities here, I played down my activity in ALA for about 4 or 5 years. However, about 1963, there was a crisis in the American Library Association about audiovisual work. Between them and the NEA's Division of Audiovisual Instruction. And they wanted to beef up the audiovisual activity in ALA and asked me to be chairman of the audiovisual committee. I took that chairmanship on for a 3-year period, during which time we did a survey of the country, and I got Walter Stone of Pittsburgh to do this. We really have given the American Library Association now an opportunity to see what the power, what the need, what the purposes and use of audiovisual in libraries can be. And I suppose that is my prime recent activity.
Are you a Phi Beta Kappa by any chance?
Yes, I got through at Columbia and made Phi Beta. I have also been made a member of Beta Phi Mu, which is the library honorary. I came into that. It was founded about 1954. Now, of course, this was some 20 years after I was in library school. So I came in as a senior member, but I have been very interested in that program. I have been on nominating committees for it and done other things to help it advance.
Now, the list of these, of course, will appear in the appendix. Very good. When you edit it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there anything else on this line?
Well, I really feel that recently I have understood more about Purdue than ever before, because in the state I have worked on the legislature as a member of a first legislative committee. Advisory committee to the legislators, and recently I worked on a studies committee, a grant from Washington, $250,000 to study in service in Indiana, and of course I've always seen Purdue as part of this. and both with the legislature and recently with this institution, study of the institution of libraries. And I have developed out of this, I think, a certain perspective about Purdue. I don't expect, I see Purdue as an Indiana phenomenon more, and I see what Indiana has done to Purdue better than I understood back
that
in the
is, 50s. I encounter two ideas. One, Purdue is unique because it is a land-grant school, and then the other, that Purdue exists to serve the needs of the citizens of Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Now, Purdue has to be an institution like other institutions. If it's going to be an AAU, it's got to perform academically according to AAU standards. On the other hand, there's no question about it, the guy who has the money calls the tune. And the legislature, while I think it understands something of this, nevertheless it has very definite reasons why it supports Purdue and very definite reasons why it won't support Purdue. And when you encounter these, you find them, you talk about non-negotiable demands, you find the legislature is practically the same as their children. About being non-negotiable. You simply don't negotiate with them. They tell you what they're going to do. So I suppose, partly age, but you get philosophical about this kind of thing. That's not a bad note to end on, that philosophy.
Would you like to end on it?
Yes, I think I should.
Well, now, just for a second, is there anything we've neglected?
I don't think so. It's a long, sad story.